Blog Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a seventh great grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation. Thank you.
city and the countryside to sin. The price of life's too high to give up, gotta come down again. Worldwide war's over and done, and the dream of peace comes true. I'll be drinking free bubble up, eating that rainbow stew. Let me find out how to burn water, and the gasoline car's gone. When an airplane flies without any fuel, and the sunlight heats our home. One of these days when the air clears up and the sun comes shining through, I'll be drinking free bubble up, needing that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew, the silver spoon, and it eats that sky blue. I'll be drinking free bubble up, needing that rainbow stew. All right. You don't have to get high to get happy. Just think about what's in store. When people start doing what they ought to be doing, they won't be booing no more. When a president goes to the White House door and does what he says he'll do, well, I'll be drinking free bubble up, eating that rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew and silver stew, and eat that sky blue. I'll be drinking that free bubble up, eating some rainbow stew. Eating rainbow stew and a silver spoon underneath that sky blue. I'll be drinking that free bubble up, eating some rainbow stew.
Yeah, that's, believe it or not, that's an old friend of mine. I met him years ago. I used to play country music for a living. This is your old buddy, Blue Otter, coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the land, the ancient land of the Aniuntikwalaski, the Cherokee protectors, military protectors of the Cherokee Nation, the people of the lightning and thunder. Ralph, are you on the line with me?
Yes, sir, I am, Will.
How do you like? That's a cute song, isn't it? I talk with you.
Oh, man, Rainbow Stew, I love it.
Well, I used to play music and earlier I was thinking about playing and maybe on a break or something. If you need to use the facilities, I'll play Robert Robertson's the Lights. But I got to thinking about the content of tonight's show and I thought, oh man, that's just perfect. And well, folks, this is Ralph Ring. Free energy is something that's close to my heart. I have another good friend by the name of Sterling Allen. I don't know if you've heard of Sterling, Ralph. He's got a...
friend of mine.
Oh, yeah. I thought you know him, huh?
I do.
Since, like, 92. He headed up something called the American Study Group in Utah. And then we used to live in the same valley, and I get news from... I'm on his news group, David's Outcasts, on Yahoo.com. But, yeah, tell us about your work. Tell us about yourself.
Okay, well, since this is the first time I've been on your show, I probably should start at the beginning and work up. A lot of the listeners may have heard some of this if they've gone on our website and downloaded some of the videos, but I'll be brief and go through and catch up to where we're at today and what we're doing, and then if there's any questions or anything, don't hesitate, because I get lost sometimes without questions.
So, no problem.
All right, it started for me. Let's see. Well, I was in the service, I got into infantry. I kept trying to get into engineering, and they put me back in the infantry, and they shipped me eventually over to Guam, and the Korean War broke out, and they transferred me to the 3rd Division. We made the Wonchon landing in North Korea. And that was a real drag. I didn't care much for war and fighting and everything. Very cold. It was 70 degrees below at one time, I remember. And so anyway, did a lot of fighting, got wounded a few times, and came back to the States.
What branch were you in?
was in the 3rd Division Army, 3rd Division 7th Regimental Combat Team.
Sounded like you went
fancy
on.
Name, but it was just a bunch of warriors wanted to fight.
Sounded like you went through a little bit of what the Marines went through at the Chosin Reservoir. That was a mess.
Well, that's what we did. We came in to rescue them because we were the first ones to land, and that was our job to go up and get those guys out because they were surrounded.
Oh,
and
my.
We did. We went up there, and I got lost, and I wound up with frostbite and stuff. But it was a heck of a battle. And they were right down in a foxhole with us. It was not very comfortable at all.
Jeez. Well, thanks for your service.
Oh, well, my pleasure, man. But there's easier ways to solve problems than fighting.
Yes. Wow, you know, that was a mess. You ever see that?
So I got out of the service, and I got back, and I kept putting in for engineering school because, I didn't have much of a background in the way of work. I was a machinist when I was a kid and did a few things here and there. But when I got out and looked at the paper, they didn't have any jobs for a regimental combat team or a machine gunner or a mortar operator. So I didn't know what the heck to do. But while I was on Guam, I did a lot of diving, skin diving and stuff. And I really, really liked the underwater world. So I figured, well, I'll kind of push the envelope here and put an ad in for if anybody wants a skin diver, I'm available. And I did, and I started getting calls, so I created a little business, Skin Divers Incorporated, San Francisco.
Wow.
And that built up it just built up overnight. And I got into some hard hat diving and stuff. I didn't like that too well, but I stayed with I got into scuba then, and I stayed with the skin diving and scuba diving and recovery, rescue, underwater photography, mining.
Wow.
Had quite a bit of repertoire.
I'm old enough to remember Sea Hunt. Most people aren't. Lloyd Bridges.
Well, that's kind of where I got the idea, man. Wow. I was watching Sea Hunt one night, and I said, well, I can do that. And I put an ad in the paper, and it worked. It went really well. I wound up going up to Northern California and doing underwater gold mining with the guy that wanted to prove his suction dredge. And that was fun. It was pure fun. And I made a little money out of it, too. It was good.
What river were you on?
North Fork of the Trinity. That's where we made our eureka. We found a lot of gold. And in about a foot and a half foot of water, that's all. We found a crevice.
I met a guy up in Siskiyou County. He owned 1 mile of claim on the river up there. And he was dredging one day, and he had switched to a larger funnel and or a larger dredge nozzle, uh-huh. And he actually got his head stuck in there, and all the way up to the bridge of his nose. Yeah, and luckily the Karuk Nation that day there was a guy doing a rotation who was knew how to do a microsurgery and was a plastic surgeon, put him back together again. But, I was up there for about 3 months. And anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. You had some amazing experiences.
Wow, man, he got his head caught. Well,
yeah.
it gets close sometimes. And
yeah.
You know, you can really get into it, especially if you don't know the current and what you're doing and stuff.
Oh, well, he was in 30 feet. He wouldn't go any deeper than 30 feet, but he could go for hours and hours and hours. Nobody could believe how long he could go. He and some buddies pulled 1,000 ounces out of a
in summer. That was a little better than what we did.
It was right.
We pulled about 30 ounces out, I think, but.
Yeah, it was right off of a boat launching area there near Happy Camp. And, that's an amazing, amazing area up there. And anyway, I didn't mean to get you off on that tangent, but go ahead.
No, that's okay. Well, yeah, I enjoyed the Trinity River. That was where we chose to dive, and then we got the North Fork of the Trinity and started climbing up in through there and met a couple of old-timers, Maggie and what the heck was his name? Oh, they were prospectors in the old times, and they were showing us where to go get gold, you know, and this made our journey a lot easier by having them guide us around a little bit. But anyway, long story short, I got going on different projects. Almost killed myself in San Francisco Bay. They wanted a diver to dive for an adapter that they dropped off one of their freighters, dropped it down in about 100 feet of water. No, it couldn't have been 100. It was in San Francisco Bay, but I think it was down about 10 feet of water and 20 feet of mud.
Jeez.
And I had to go diving down there to try and find it for them. And they hired me. And I didn't ask for very much. I was just starting the business, and I didn't even know what to charge these guys. But anyway, I dove down, and I spent about an hour down there fishing around and kept going deeper and deeper into the mud, and I finally found that sucker. And it was just, I only had a few breaths of air left, so I just threw a half hitch around it, and luckily it caught, and I jerked the rope for him to pull it up slow, and I got the heck out of the water. But I was trying to get up, and there's what they call camels. They're big logs right next to the pier that keep the boats from bumping into the pier, and I got stuck underneath the camels, and I ran out of air.
Oh. What were you trying to salvage?
It was an adapter with handles on it. It fitted their onboard tube to the landline tube.
I mean, oh, I see. Wow.
Transfer something. I don't even know what it was for.
So did you die?
Oh yeah, I died and came back. I'm not finished here yet. So anyway, I went up to get my pay, and they paid me. You know, they gave me, I don't know, a couple hundred dollars, I guess. And they said, one guy pulled me aside. He said, "Well, you're paid now, but I tell you, we would have paid you $10,000 to rescue that thing. It was costing like $20,000 or $30,000 to keep that thing tied up there every day."
Wow.
So anyway, I was learning about money then.
Yeah, I've got a friend.
And, I'll cut it short. I went down to Southern California. I worked my way down the coast. I went into Santa Barbara for a while. My sister lived there, and just started diving abalone just for the heck of it. The abalone diving was kind of fun. And then I worked my way down to Newport Beach. My uncle lived down there. And I was out diving, just doing my work, doing my thing. And one day a dive boat from U.S. Divers, that's the Aqualung company that Jacques Cousteau created, a dive boat pulled up and heard about my daring dives. They were daring because I understood natural law and understood what I could do, and I didn't have much fear when I knew my limits, but it sounded pretty good to me. They said, you know, that they wanted me to come in for an interview. They'd like me to talk to them about about their research and development facility. So I did. I went in, and they hired me right away. And
wow,
I got involved with that.
I lived in Newport Beach between 65 and 67.
Beg pardon?
I lived in Newport Beach between 65 and 67.
Wow. Okay, well, you know the area.
Yeah.
Now you can't touch that thing with...
What years were you in?
I was there in 55, 6. Let's see.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't much there then. Yeah, it's... let's see. Was that before or after the big Boy Scout Jamboree? They had, I can't remember what year they had of the World Jamboree in Newport Beach. And they had it on a bluff that they later turned into a subdivision called East Bluff. And when my parents put in the first lawn there, we discovered there's three campfires there that we had to put lawn over. So I know the area real well. beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, it was at one time. I haven't been back recently, but I've heard it was pretty crowded. And
oh, yeah.
And stuff. But anyway, I got Marsha's flashing me a note here. Let me see. What do you got? Oh, talk about spaceships and consciousness. I'll get that.
Yeah.
Well, Marsha's here, too, by the way, Will. I want to introduce you to my wife, Marsha.
Hello there.
Hey, how are you doing? You got to keep us on task.
Well, he has such a good story, and I know that people are really interested in hearing it, Will. And that's why I want him, you know, the fun things are fun, too, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll get on with it. We're just finding now. I got a lot more in common with him than I thought.
It's amazing that he said he knew you before, so that's wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I think he's been a member of the Native Prophecy Council. He may have even been the first one.
We go back a ways. Well, I remember. Anyway, I got to work for divers, and that was going pretty well. But I was going out to going to the islands, Catalina, and so forth, and testing equipment, and had a couple of. They weren't dangerous to me, but when the word got back to my wife, I had a couple of incidences. Ran out of air at 250 feet, and to a diver, that's nothing because you can. And I was only down there less than 5 minutes, so I didn't have to hang off. And I just came up, blowing my air out, blowing my lungs out, and nothing to it for me. But when the word got back to my wife, I was raising kids then too. I had two kids.
Oh wow.
She said, you know, we need a papa around the house and somebody to take the trash out. You guys are out there, you know, 2 and 3 days, sometimes a week. So I kind of ignored her for a while because I was making pretty good money and taking care of things. But a couple of more little incidents, we got caught in a storm out there and capsized the boat and stuff. And so she got a little nervous. And one day I was having breakfast, having my cornflakes, and she put a classified ad over my top of my cornflakes, circle and lipstick. It was a job offer for a lab tech at a research and development center, right about 2 or 3 blocks from my house. I lived in Costa Mesa at that time.
Uh-huh. I went to Orange Coast College, so.
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I took marine biology and oceanography there.
Did you ever meet a guy by the name of John Zeldis? He's a oceanographer. He and I went to Franklin Elementary School in Santa Monica, like in 60, 61, 62, and we used to play together all the time. And I found out anyway, I just was curious. I think he's in New Zealand now. Anyway,
I might have known him, but God, man, a million names and faces sometimes don't match up. I know their energy when I feel them again, but it doesn't ring a bell right now. But anyhow, I took some courses at Orange Coast, and then I went to Irvine and took a course in zoology, and I don't know, I got mixed up in different things. But that's when I thought my career was going to be diving. And one day I looked at the bulletin board at Orange Coast, and they said they want a marine biologist, and they pay him $500 a month. And at that time, I'd started a little house cleaning business, and I was making $500 a week. So I said, you know, I don't think I'm going to go much further with this, because I think on my own I can probably do okay without getting tied up in an organization or a system or a corporate structure of any kind. So I kind of went off on my own doing things, like I did with the diving. And anyway, I told my wife, well, I don't have any experience. I'm a diver, and that's just about it. But in my spare time, I was going around to garage sales and swap meets, and I gathered up all kinds of stuff, and I was experimenting. I used my living room floor was better than my garage. My garage was small, but I had some tools out there I could work with, but I'd always put ideas together and make them work around the house. So she thought, well, that'll qualify. You know natural law, because I was raised up here where I am now. I'm in Paradise, California. And I was raised up here. I was here in the 40s. And I went, my sister and I walked back and forth to school, 7 miles round trip. So my best knowledge and wisdom and understanding of life came from walking in the woods. Learned about natural law. So everything I put together was based on natural law. Just down-earth simplicity. Just everything in nature is really, really simple. So I was running these things around the house on remotes and everything, and she said, well, you go down there and tell them what you can do. See what happens. So I did. I went down there. It was lunchtime. There was nobody. The receptionist wasn't there. And I walked down the halls, and I couldn't see anybody. So I was getting ready to leave, and I walked by the director's office. And he saw me. He said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm looking for a job. And he said, well, you have to come back. You'll be there at lunch or something. I said, okay, see ya. I was ready to get out of there. And he said, well, wait a minute. What are you looking for? And I said, well, you got this ad here for a lab tech. And he says, well, what's your qualification? I said, well, natural law. And he said, well, what are you talking about? Well, I went in to explain to him a few natural principles that rock the boat of conventional physics. And so he thought, and especially when I told him my interest has always been in magnetics, and that I love magnetism, and that I learned a lot about, you know, how things are put together. So that kind of struck a chord with him, because an engineer that had been working on a magnetic experiment for him just quit, and they needed to fill the job right away. So without an application or anything, he called one of his engineers up to guide me into the area that the experiment was going on, and he says, you can fill out an application tomorrow or something, but let him show you what we're doing here. Well, what they were doing was, the job was to fire an electron through a magnetic field without deflection. It couldn't go to the positive or negative. It had to go through the field. And I looked at it and I thought, well, it sounds sounds simple to me. And they gave me $40,000 oscilloscope and an equally expensive Xerox. Not a Xerox, but a, what did I say, oscilloscope, and Xerox camera. And they said, all you have to do is keep firing those electrons and, and writing them up and taking pictures. And I said, well, that's simple. Not much to this job at all. But after a few days, I worked there a couple of weeks before I got really tired of it. I said, well, wait a minute. These guys are trying to force this little electron and through this field. And they're never going to do that. They're pushing the envelope with Mother Nature. You can't do that. You got to give her a chance to breathe. Everything breathes. We breathe in and out. And the oceans go in and out. And, you know, everything is going ebbing and flowing. So that's a simple law of nature. So I told them, I said, you know, you're really not going to go anywhere forcing these little electrons through here. And they said, no, just be quiet and keep doing it. We'll just keep increasing the power. And just keep doing your job. Well, I saw that this wasn't going to go anywhere. And so I was getting upset, and in my head I said, oh, I can do this. It's a simple project. And the next bench over, they're working on levitation. And what they had was these coils, 6-inch iron cores with, you know, copper wire wrapped around them, just coils. And they fired them up and levitated a steel ball for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then burnt the coil up. Another stupid way to go, I thought, because, you know, they're using force again, and they're trying to buck the resistance that the coil is trying to give them. So anyway, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to go home and work on this. I went home and tore apart an old TV set,
got the cathode ray tube out of it and set the and the magnets and set up a similar experiment right on my living room floor. Not much to it at all. And my hunch was, because I watched how water comes down the river from the snow and everything, it meanders. It doesn't go in a straight line. It's not captivated by man's aqueducts and so forth as they do on down the line later. But and when I was into gold, I understood how the flows of water were very important. There are eddy currents and there's vortices, they spiral. And that's how nature breathes and everything that nature puts together. So I said, well, I'll just spiral this little baby through here, and it's called pulsing in the vernacular science. They call it pulsing the signal. So I just pulsed the signal, and this little electron, the first one I shot, went through the field because it was spiraling. It was having a chance in its own dimension to breathe, and it went right through the field, no deflection. So after about 20 of them, I said, I got it. I'm going to write this up, take some pictures, and I'm going to look for a big raise. I solved their problem in a hurry. And I'm just a lab tech, so I knew if they could pass it on to their engineers and their physicists and figure it out from there. But, you know, the idea that I used was just being patient, just pulsing the signal instead of trying to force it. So along with that, I said, well, it's a weekend, and I'll work on this other levitation thing. And the same television, I believe, or maybe the music box, I pulled a 15-inch woofer speaker out and put it on the living room floor, a magnetic base to it, and hooked up a little audio amplifier I picked up at a garage sale for about $25. And I was just playing around, you know, sending in different vibrations to this cone. And it's just like music, the cone would vibrate and everything. And what I was working, basing my hunch on, I'd watched an 8mm film way back somewhere. I don't even know where I watched the thing. I was in Tibet. The Tibetans were raising these huge blocks of stone up the side of this cliff. And they had these long horns and around these rocks and guys with drums. And all they do was play the horns and the drums till they reached a resonant frequency, as I know it as of today, of the stone. And it nullified the magnetic field of the gravity around the stone. And sure enough, they'd pull it up the side of the hill and say, well, look.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, my friend Robert Threagle, you know, Robert Shrewsbury is an old friend of mine, and also known as Robert Threagle. And this guy, in the 10 or 15 years that we weren't living in the same place, he got into metallurgy, and he built a nuclear resonance magnetometer. And there's a lot of these machines around, but he was able to figure out that resonant frequencies change slightly depending on the phase of the moon. And the Torah, he was reading in the Torah how after the flood it said that the moon would be in control of things. And so he did a spreadsheet. This guy gets $1,000 a day to go out, and if you don't find what you're looking for, he didn't get paid, but he did 6 trips back and forth between Birmingham, Alabama, and where he lives in Utah last year, and he's putting together a deal with a group in Florida right now, and magnetic resonance is amazing, and he taught me a very rudimentary method of just using a strong magnet. And he says basically, mm-hmm. if you have a sample of whatever you're looking for, you just place. He just said, you know, he said just put the magnet down on a table. It has to be wood, you know, not metal. And he says mm-hmm. put a pure sample of whatever you're looking for on the, I believe he said, the north pole of the magnet, and then you stand between whatever in, you're looking for, where the approximate area where you think you're looking for it, but you have to be in its field. And he uses a dowsing antenna. And, yeah, I was at a friend of mine's house in Colorado, and this guy legally grew marijuana. And I said, Jimmy, I said, you know, give me a little bud. And I said, I'm going to, I said, I want you to blindfold me. I said, I'm going to put earplugs in. And I said, I want you to hide some, you know, here in the room. And I said, I'll find it. He just laughed. And he, oh, no, there's no way you're going to be able to do that. And I said, no. And I said, you know, I said, I'll even go la, 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 while, so I don't even hear your footfalls. I don't want any clue. But anyway, I placed that little bud on top of that on that magnet. I turned around and I walked right over to it. It's absolutely amazing. And but that's a rudimentary way. But if you have
it is. That's the simple law of nature. If you resonate with anything, and if you don't have any fear, if you got fear, it'll slow you down because you're guessing all the time. You're doubting and fearing. And
that's what an MRI is, a magnetic resonance machine. You got frequency talking to frequency at a distance, and it's used in medicine all the time. And that's what oil companies are using to image underneath the ground. All Robert has to do is just stick a couple of spikes in the ground and broadcast the resonant frequency of whatever element he's looking for, or a cord of four elements. And he does that for about 45 minutes. He just turns on his machine and goes and finds it.
Cool. That's cool. I'm glad that, you know, that's coming to the surface fast now, because we need it. We need to get into that kind of stuff, because they've been so far behind, and they've really shelved a lot of things, hidden a lot of things from people, and it's except for their own best interest, they've done a lot of that too.
Yeah.
But now it's got to come out, and that's what Marsh and I are trying to do is we go around on lectures. We've been all over the United States and in Hawaii and stuff, and just waking people up. Just tell them, hey, know who you are. Know who you really are, not who you think you are and stuff. And it's kind of shaking their cage a little bit, you know. But it's working. People are starting to question themselves now, find out who they are. It's kind of cool. But anyway, getting back to the story, if you like. Hello?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. The only other thing I was going to say is Sterling Allen recently came back from South Africa with a machine, and you know, it looks like they're going to have marketable home energy units coming up, and around $5,000, something like that. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, that's cool, man. That's beautiful. Yeah, I try to keep up with him. I got his website, and I try to keep up on freeenergy.com. But I notice he's doing that guy. You know, God bless him. He's bringing out information daily for people to look at, and showing the little guys working in their garages trying to get these ideas out to people. Well, anyway, so let's see. Where was I? I was talking about. I'm stuck way back on the job, aren't I? Well, I wrote that. I played around with it till I found a ping pong ball, and I put that in the center of the cone, and bingo, I hit the right vibrations and suspended the ping pong ball in the center of this 15-inch woofer speaker. And the whole job must have cost me $30 or something. I don't know. So I said, well, there goes that one. I'll look around the lab and see if there's any others I can put my ideas to. And so I wrote it up, took pictures of it, and I thought I was really going to get a nice raise. So I walked in and got an audience with Dr. Weinhardt, and I said, guess what? I think I'm on to something. I know I don't know much. I'm just a lab tech, but turn these over to the engineers. I think we got something we work on here. He said, what you got? And I showed him. He looked at the pictures and read the report, and he says, you know, Ralph, I'm a physicist, and I see where you're going with this, but, you know, we're not there yet. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, where you're working here, this is advanced kinetics. We're connected with
government funding. We get grants to do our job here. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he says, well, you don't understand. In government funding, you're paid to look for the answers, not find them. And that's the words he told me. You know, and I... And I that my whole world changed, and that just 5 seconds, my whole world, my stomach dropped. I didn't know where I was at. Like, where in the hell am I? I couldn't believe what I was hearing. But he said, no, that's the way it is. He says, I'm kind of sorry you discovered that, because I don't want you talking to any of the engineers about this. I'm going to have to shred this. You go back to work, we'll put some more money in your envelope, but don't you dare, not a word of this to anybody else. And I said, well,
sure. Yeah.
You know, I thought we were here to progress. And he said, no, we're here to make money. So
that was
the beginning of the end of that job. About 2 weeks later, I had to walk off. In fact, I was crying when I went out the door, because I thought, man, you guys are missing it. You're working on laws that they're just going to chase your tail all your lives. You're not going to go anywhere. And I was mostly crying because I had to go home and face my wife and my kids. I just quit my job. So anyway, long story short, on my way home, I met one of my neighbors, and he was telling me about, I was telling him the whole story, and he says, well, man, those ideas are not bad at all. There's a lot of people that want to do those things, that they're kind of held under the pressure of the ideas that you can't and you won't and you don't and stuff. But they have a meeting once a week, and it's called Understanding. It was held there in Costa Mesa. And the guy that put it together was Daniel Pry. And he said, why don't you come on over? I'll go with you. Come on over one of these nights and tell them what you told me. Because you'll find other people doing the same things in their own field. They're working under garages and underneath their carports and stuff, putting things together. So I was okay. So I went over, and what a nice bunch of people. I mean, they were open-minded. I couldn't believe it. Because they listened to my story and said, yeah, we know exactly where you're at, and we know how you're feeling and everything, and we've gone through a lot of this stuff ourselves. But tell us more. And I said, well, since I've been a kid, I come out of the woods to see what this world out here was like, and I couldn't, it was just totally different, because everything was going backwards, going in the wrong direction as far as I was concerned. I was just a kid, but, and they said, what are you talking about? I said, well, if you look at the clouds, and I was just using an example, but I said, you look at the clouds, you look at a clear sky first, and then you see these little vapors coming together and formulating into clouds, and pretty soon more and more clouds, and pretty soon you got rain, and not just for 5 or 10 minutes, but sometimes for 5 and 10 days. Now, that's a lot of water being suspended up above our heads, and I mean, hundreds and hundreds of tons, hundreds of thousands of tons are being held up there in natural, simple levitation.
Hmm.
And that's magnetic resonance. And that's how nature operates. When the plants need water, they just signal, okay, I'm ready. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's a little more detailed than that. But that's basically what happens. So I said... And so I wanted to see floating homes. I thought, well, why don't we get these tires off the ground, all this pavement and cement and asphalt and rubber, and let's get it back to the garden, because I saw them tear up some beautiful parks just to put a freeway in. And I thought, man, let's just get that tire from the vertical position and get it into a horizontal position. Let's have floating homes, and using magnetic power, using magnetism, is really simpler than it sounds. And so they said, well, tell us a little more. I said, well, it's just like RVs in the sky. Let's get out of the Flintstone era and get into the Jetson era. And they said, well, you mean like a spaceship? I said, yeah. Yeah, we could have floating homes, floating cities, floating countries, anything we want. We're on a spaceship right now. And I spent some time in Washington, northern part of Washington. Well, it's around Seattle, but I met Bucky Fuller up there.
Really?
And he was always talking, you know, geometry and then sacred geometry, and about the fact that we're on a spaceship. This is just one gigantic spaceship. And so I thought, well, cool, let's bring that principle down and get things off the ground so we can move around without a lot of congestion and stuff. And I knew with magnetism, you don't have to bump into anybody, so that's not going to be any accidents to worry about. So they said, well, you don't sound strange to us. We know a guy in Oklahoma who's working in Norman, Oklahoma right now. His name is Otis Carr, and he was a direct disciple of Nikola Tesla. He
wow.
met Tesla working as a night clerk in the New Yorker Hotel and became friends with him. Tesla would send him out for peanuts and food sometimes. But Carr was a sponge. He's basically a science-oriented person. And like myself, he liked natural law. And Tesla was really adamant about sharing things with Carr, because he was an open mind. He didn't resist anything, and he was receptive. And Tesla told him the story that he'd gone so far with the Edison Company and the Westinghouse. That was funded all by J.P. Morgan, the money man of the time. And they'd gone so far as to fund his operations in Colorado Springs. He had a
mm-hmm. They made a movie about
lab there, huh? And also on the north edge of Manhattan, New Jersey. It's
mm-hmm.
called Warden Cliff, I believe is the name of it. He was going to build this tower, and at the time, J.P. Morgan wasn't too worried about it until Tesla came in and said, we're ready to transmit electricity through the air without wires. We no longer need wires. They're going to be obsolete. And that blew, I'm paraphrasing everything, and I'm metaphoring everything because I wasn't there, but it blew his fuse, blew J.P. Morgan's fuse, because he said, no, man, you can't do that. You're going to put everybody out of business. You know, we got the lumber industry. We need to cut those logs down and build telephone poles. And we need to dig holes in the ground and get the copper and make wire and transmit this electricity and then put meters on it so people can be comfortable in their homes and pay us lots of money. He didn't say that. But so Carr said, no, we don't need that. We can transmit electrical power, what you're calling electrical power, through the earth. Around the ionosphere, bounce a signal all around the Earth and give everybody free and abundant energy forever, because we're living in a big ocean of energy, big sea of energy. And long story short, J.P. Morgan told Tesla, no, and we're going to have to stop you from going any further with this. So they went in and tore his tower down in Manhattan, and before they could tear his place down in Colorado Springs, he was able to transmit power all over the place. He had light bulbs, you know, miles away. He was lighting up from the Tesla coils that he produced. So, but anyway, they basically shut him down, and he transmitted all this information to Carr, and he says, they don't want me to operate anymore. They're locking me in a box. So you take this information, I'll give you everything I can, and you pass it on, because this eventually, sooner or later, they're digging their own grave. They're on their way to extinction, and you're going to have to take this and run with it, and see what you can do. And if you can't do it, pass it on, because we've got to wake people up to getting back to natural law, getting back to the simple laws of nature, because the way they're going is they're chasing their tails, and they're building things stronger and stronger with force, and they're killing themselves. So, long story short, Carr said, "Go, I'll do this." And so he already had his own small laboratory, but eventually he started OTC Lab Incorporated in Baltimore, Maryland, and started designing and building alternative energies. But his pet, he always wanted to build spaceships. So he started developing the Tesla technology that enabled him to understand how simple it was, started putting these things together. But the powers that be in those days, which was the power companies and the lumber industries or whoever they happened to be, didn't really want him to be around. So they gave him a hard time. Everywhere he went, they were giving him a hard time. And so the understanding group that was telling me all this said, "He's out there now, but he's under a lot of pressure. They're calling him a fraud, and he doesn't know what he's talking about," and so forth. So you guys sound like you're talking about the same thing. "How would you like to get together?" And I said, "Oh, man, I'd love it." So within a week, they got it all together. I don't know, it was a big miracle as far as I was concerned, because I didn't know how it was all going to happen. But they gave me a call, and they said, "Carr's on his way with his entourage. He's got about, you know, six or eight. He's got engineers and a physicist and PR people and stuff, but he's on his way. And we're going to put you guys up at Lake Arrowhead. We got a huge cabin up there, and you guys can stay up there till we figure out. We'll just turn it over to Spirit and find you a place to work." So that's cool. So they set him out, and I met him. And when I met him, man, it was like shaking hands with destiny, because him and I were natural law from the get-go. We just understood. We just looked in each other's eyes, and we knew that what was around us wasn't real compared to what we knew could be. And he said, "You ready to go with us?" I said, "Yeah, let's go." So we went up to the cabin. I got acquainted with all the other guys, the engineers and stuff. And they were pretty knowledgeable. They had the spirit of adventure, the spirit of ideas, and the spirit of actually going completely immersed, getting completely immersed in free energy. So, but I
I'll remember.
Go ahead,
where
Will.
I'm
blabbing away here.
I'll remember where you were about being completely immersed in free energy. I really wish. See, my dad graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1939 in civil engineering.
Wow.
And he had like a 55, 60-year career. I mean, when he passed away, he was living in Oak Ridge. But he always regretted that he was a company man, and he had that fear. He didn't want to break up. But he ran a division for Donald Douglas in the early 60s, they wouldn't take him in the Army in World War II because he was too skinny. But he was working in Wichita for Boeing, and they want him to escort the prototype for the magnesium nose casting for the B-29 bomber to Wright Pat. And he told me about things like a certain hangar that he saw a certain disc in, and he spent so much time up at Apple Valley that they call him the mayor of Apple Valley, and he saw a lot of things. He had a Q clearance, and he told me about seeing levitation experiments. He was fascinated with high-speed trains that ran on magnetic, rails, and his brother graduated from the Naval Academy in '45, and he was a lifelong. And they called him Mr. Sonobui. He invented and ran SOSIS. You saw Hunt for Red October until he retired in 1980. And I know where you're coming from. And Dad just had this hunger. He was afraid. He had a family, and he was afraid to kind of break out of the mold. And boy, I wished he would have hooked up with you.
Oh, man. Well, I wish you had, too.
Because he was, man, he knew stress analysis. Well, you know, he chased. You know, we lived in Newport Beach from '65 to '67, and I guess Johnson pulled the plug on aerospace, and then we went to Martin Marietta in Orlando. He worked on Nike Zeus until that was over with, and then we moved up to Long Island, and he was working at Bethpage for Grumman. They did the trajectory analysis for Voyager, the Grand Tour. And then, you know, the space program was over there for a while, so he got into manufactured housing for a few years. But by 72, he was back in California working for Garrett Air Research, and I worked for them until he retired, and eventually moved back to Oak Ridge, and back to California, and back to Oak Ridge, where they were. His first job was in Clinton, Tennessee, and he wanted to retire here. And I met my mom down in Mississippi. Her dad worked for the Corps of Engineers. So, yeah, engineering runs in my blood, you know. But I couldn't. I scored highest on SATs in physical science, but I never could wrap my head around calculus. That was good in math. And my uncle, you know, being a gunnery officer, first thing he did in World War II, he says the teachers don't teach the application for calculus. And, you know, about that time, all that movie about those kids in West Virginia, what was it called, October, about them, you know, designing a rocket, and they had to prove that they didn't start a fire, and so they used calculus to go and figure out exactly where the trajectory or where it would have landed, and they ended up in the space program. But it was just...
Was that David Adair? You know who David Adair is?
I think so.
He was 7 years old. He understood quantum physics.
Yeah.
And at 13, he was building rockets and out in the cow pasture.
His dad was a miner, and they lived in a company town in West Virginia. They made a movie called October... I just can't think about it right now. It's just... I've always been fascinated with the subject, and I've had a lot of UFO experiences. So I'll shut up. Go back. You know, you were talking about.
Well, don't
you know,
shut up.
but to tie in
with that, and this might be, you know, good for your radio audience if they haven't heard of him. Just go to the internet and type in David Adair, and it'll lead you right to a website, or go to our website. Go up to BlueStarEnterprise.com. And he's on our front page right now. And this kid, he was born with nature coming out of his ears. And so he designed and built these rockets, and they got onto him and wanted him to, they took him to Wright-Patterson, and they wanted him to shoot these rockets over to Area 51. But it's an interesting story, and it goes into the etheric realms of who and what we are and what kind of energy we're dealing with. And it's a real... I won't get into it more than
that.
But
it's a video. David Adair at Area 51. It's a picture of a U.S. Air Force security guy.
Yeah,
he's
got a uniform with a on the front with a spaceship in the back or something.
I've heard him talk on Coast to Coast years ago. He's amazing.
Oh, okay.
Amazing.
Person. Yeah, he is. There's a lot of. A lot of guys like that. They've cut loose, and they're their own.
Well, he was like
self-made 16. Person, you know.
Yeah, he was like 16 years old. He went to work for the government. He was just, mm-hmm. If that's the guy I'm thinking about, yeah.
17 years old. He flew his rocket faster than the speed of a bullet over to the Area 51. I think it was like. Thousands of miles an hour. I don't know what it was, but
well, my Cherokee teacher John Red Hat was Colonel John Duke, and he spent 30 years in the Air Force. He was a 06 full bird colonel when he retired. He was a traditional Cherokee teacher, and you can read about him at Kitua Society, KETOOWAH Society.org. And he told me he did.
What was that again? Let me write it down. What was that again?
K E E T O O W A H Society.org. John Red Hat is an Air Force officer. He told me that he did. He flew a F-111 Starfighter with a test plane with iridium skin. You know, he lived around Colorado Springs. You know, he was attached to NORAD there, and they pulled him out of retirement. He was born and raised a traditional Cherokee by Cherokee-speaking grandmothers and black freedwoman, and got involved in the Air Force. And he, as a teen, he converted to Judaism and became a rabbi. And so they pulled him out of retirement during Desert Storm to be the U.S. Air Force liaison with the IDF Air Force, and he saw things. They showed him things. They've got weapons that nobody that you know you don't know about. They showed him some things. They said, "Go home and tell your government we've got five of these." And I'll tell you off the air, you know, but he's dead now, but they can come after me. But anyway, yeah, it's so exciting, but there's so much suppression. They suppress everything, and I think everybody knows that, you know, there's carburetors out there that could get 100 miles a gallon, and everybody's, the powers that be are just so greedy. They want people chained. It's such a shame. But you were talking about being totally immersed in the culture.
It's really a world of servitude. You know, they have the few that are controlling and powering over the many, and that's got to change. Marcia's grabbing a phone. Hang on.
You know what's exciting to me is that now's the time. It is changing, and we're hearing so many and getting so many people coming in touch with us. College students that are saying we're interested in what you're doing, and there's so many little inventors all over that we're in touch with, and it's happening now, and so that's we're really blessed to be at in this life at this time, because we're going to see the whole universe, the whole multiverse change in the next few, you know, months, I hope, but it might take a year or so, but it's happening now, and that's what's so exciting. I'm very happy to be part of this natural energy phenomena.
Well, I'll bet Ralph's glad to see it, you know, particularly, you know, after a lifetime, and I don't know how old he is. I imagine he's, you know, he's probably born about 1920. What year was Ralph born in?
I was born in 34. I'm a double seven right now.
Oh, okay, 34. So you're like 78.
Coming up 78. Yeah.
Yeah. And boy, I'll bet you're glad to see something finally happening after all. You know.
Yeah, man. Well,
after Star Trek and X-Files and things finally cutting loose.
Yeah, we've reached critical mass. It's a downhill from here on, but it won't seem like it to a lot of people that haven't, you know, gone to their source for their information. If they're outside looking for answers, they're never going to find them, because it's the old squirrel cage, round and around, the same old dumb answers that they get.
Well, what do you think about Michio Kaku went public months ago? He said, you know, we made a mistake in our mathematics, and he says there's a bigger problem with the sun than we thought, and they expect something could possibly happen in 2012, and of course, the prophecy talks about, you know, about problems with the sun, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens between now and the end of the year, because you know, the Mayan elders I interviewed, they said, you know, nothing's written in stone, but something is going to happen, and there will be changes, and but if we can live through it peacefully until we can, you know, go from a level zero civilization to at least a level one, you know, like Professor Kaku was talking about. I listen to his show every Saturday night, and on the local talk show, and he always has some good guests. And but anyway, go ahead. You were talking about getting totally immersed in.
Well, that reminds me, I don't know whether we're, Marcia and I are both good friends with the Hopi and the Navajo, and we've been back and forth. And just recently, a guy that was writing a book, what was his name, Gary David?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote some books, but I'm not 100% clear on all the accuracy of the book. But anyway, one of the things he did was go up to Hopi land, and Grandfather Martin took him out to a prophecy rock, and there etched on that rock thousands of years ago was the OTCX-1. That's the craft that we're building now, is the OTCX-1. And you can see it carved into the rock. It's on our website. I believe people can plug in and take a look at it.
And when you get to that point, we're talking about the OTC ship, my friend Mark Bercheting wanted to ask you, why do you think the color aquamarine was being emitted by the crystals or whatever in the center of the OTC ship that you rode in? But we'll shelve that till you actually get to start talking about it.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a little brief now, and then we'll come right on up to full bore, and I'll give you the whole peanut. Well, aquamarine, I didn't know it at the time. And then the engineers just went out and measured a piece of land, and it just happened to be, when they measured it with light frequencies and vibration, to equate to the colors and the light spectrum of aquamarine. And that's how that was. I didn't think anything more about it until somebody had seen it on our web. I did an interview for Project Camelot years ago, and somebody had heard about it, and they wrote us an email about aquamarine. It really shocked me. It's supposed to be one of the transitional light, the frequencies of aquamarine are incredibly powerful. And they are deal with transition from one dimension to another, making that entirely possible very easily. And to be able to ascend in your consciousness to higher levels of understanding and so forth. So, and much more. Marcia, do you remember any more about that? What we got on it?
Well, the actual email that came to us about it said that they definitely had heard us speak, and there was absolutely no doubt in their minds that the aquamarine was the higher vibration of transition, and that would be for now too. But and they went on to explain the meaning of it, and I don't have it right here in my head right now, but it really resonated with Ralph, and it sounded very beautiful to me too.
It goes through quartz crystal very, very purely. I mean, it doesn't get snagged and sidetracked, but
I think I got you.
For some reason, the frequency of aquamarine goes through quartz just like now. So
I think I got you ahead of the thing you were talking about. Just getting in with okay. the engineering group with Otis Carr, and
let's get back to that. So we sat up and talked all night long, and he was explaining to me about what he was doing with Spacious, and I, explained to him that I wanted to see RVs in the sky. Let's get them off the ground. So he says, okay, let's work together. But it had to be, from that point on, a spiritual venture. It could no longer be, held just only to a third-dimensional conception of what life was and so forth. So we got into some heavy talk about who we are and what we are. And we are actually light beings. We're energy beings. And we're here for a visit. We were here to try a machine out, to see how we could operate through a machine, a water vessel or whatever, and don't get stuck here. But so in order to evolve the species, the races, we would have to keep our head above the clouds and keep operating in what he termed the ethers, that everything from that point on had to come from the ethers. And no longer atmosphere and stratosphere and all the other spheres that are talked about in man science, but the ethers deals with etheric energy that is far and above. It's just pure in its essence. So I said, cool, teach me. Well, I knew a little bit about it. I'd studied esoteric things and stuff, so I was kind of on the same page with him. So anyway, a week later or so, they gave us a call and they said, we got you a factory, a facility, including a factory.
workshop. We had a machine shop, a tool and die, laboratory, barracks, and offices. It had the works. And we thought, wow, man, nature's coming with us. We're being met with, we created a vacuum by saying we're going to do this, and we're not taking over an answer. We're going to bring free energy back, because it's always been free and abundant. And then along came the ideas that, well, man, we can put meters on this and make money, and we'll feed the poor, we'll feed the
right.
Less, but they never have, you know.
The road to hell is reminds me of that Leonard Cohen song. The line is, this is not a technological problem. This is the road to hell. Okay, but yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. So they said, and this is down the backside of where we were. We were at Lake Arrowhead, and the backside of that is the San Bernardino Valley. And a place called Hesperia. It's out of Apple Valley, next to Victorville, I think it is. And so we got you the facilities. You guys, boys, can go down and go to work. Let's see some spaceships. So more or less, I'm kind of paraphrasing everything and kind of ad-libbing here, but basically that's what happened. But before we went down, Carr made sure that consciousness was our main objective. Every morning when we got up, we had to see the world as beautiful, and then we had to get the rest of the world to see it as beautiful, so we could all experience living in a world without fear and without doubts and without just being who and what they are and pursuing their own talents, whatever that might be, and not worried about punching a time clock and I can't, I won't, I don't. All the other things that went with it. And I said, okay, I'm with you. So we went down. They got this facility, beautiful facility. It's just only on about an acre of land. But, well, we set up shop, and he brought a lot of things with him. But we started, and I was a machinist when I was a kid, so I said, well, I'll help you guys turn out some parts if you want. So I did that, and I was a little bit of a gopher boy, because I'd go for hamburgers and stuff when the guys needed it. But I was intrigued with this ether technology that he's talking about, and that came directly from Tesla. Tesla said that they came into this world in spirit, and the only way they're ever going to get out of it is in spirit, because the body, what they're calling the body, it doesn't really exist, but they don't know that. You know, talk like that. But I got used to it, now I talk like that. People think I'm nuts.
he must have been a Hank Williams fan. You'll never get out of this world alive.
yeah. That's, you got it. So we went down, we started building these little prototypes, and I was surprised how fast we built them, but he was building them before, so it wasn't much till we had these little models. In those days, we didn't have remotes. We didn't have, little remote airplane motors and stuff that you could use a remote with. But we had these little craft flying all over Apple Valley. And sometimes the corona around them would shine really bright, and people thought they were flying saucers. And so
they were.
Yeah, well, I guess they were, weren't they?
There's the Apple Valley. Okay, yeah, see, my dad was up there. He says, I couldn't tell you what I'm doing. So he was up there with you. His name was Les Anderson.
Ah, Les Anderson. Huh?
Yeah. And he would have been. You may have run into him. He told me about, a little. He said, I can't tell you, but he says we're doing all kinds of stuff up there with levitation, and there was a lot of strange stuff going on up there.
God. He was probably one of us, and I didn't know it. I don't remember any of the guys' names or anything now, and they were all just great people, but boy, they were knowledgeable, man. They knew their stuff and everything we were working with. And we all synergized. We all resonated with it. We all loved what we were doing. And we'd stay up. We'd go to sleep on the job. I remember going to sleep on the engine lathe a couple of times, just catnapping, waking up and going back to work, because I was intrigued with this whole idea of building spaceships. So we got these prototypes going around the valley, and they were going good, and we got to a point where Carr called this PR guy, and he's a friend of ours. His name was Major Wayne Aho. He was in the intelligence in the Army, and I guess it was Project Blue Book or one of those things, and he finally quit. He got out of the service because people are being lied to. They're not, they won't allow me to talk about the stuff that's been going on. And he says, I can't do that. So he got out of the service, and he hooked up with Carr, and he was our PR man. And when we had a prototype ready to go, Carr said, well, let's find a manufacturer. We've gone as far as we can go. And we were working, for the most part, out of pocket. We had few donations here and there, but we were doing everything ourselves. We couldn't afford to manufacture these things, so we called in General Motors. And they sent a rep out to talk to us in Riverside. We met at one of the places in Riverside, and they had their engineers with them. They had two or three engineers and the physicist, and I don't know who all, and they had their cameras and everything, and we just went with a little suitcase. That's all we had. And I went with those two. There was Wayne Aho and two or three engineers, myself and Carr. And we just had a little suitcase with one of our prototypes in it. And so we walked in, and he says, "Well, what do you want to talk about?" And we said, "Well, we really, you know, we want to tell you something before we show you something." And so we explained that we could now, you know, take the next step in evolution. We can go to the next step quite easily, and we don't have to do it drastically. We can gradually fade it in with what's happening if we don't wait too long. Otherwise, it could be really drastic if you have to wait till the last minute. But he said, well, what are you talking about? Well, you know, the Amos still have horses, and they're happy with them, horse and carriages, and people still have their Corvettes and Maseratis or whatever they want, and they're happy with them. And we don't want to change any of that, but we want to add to the system by introducing spaceships, getting things off the ground. He said, well, yeah, what are you talking about? The car opened his suitcase up, took this little craft out, about 12 inches in diameter, set it on the rep's desk, and just let it sit there, and continue to talk about it. He said, well, we want to put these up, take the wheel, put it horizontally, and everybody can have their homes that can move around, and they won't have to worry about anything because they can incorporate the same things they got on the ground in their spaceship. And the guy was saying, yeah, it's impossible and so forth. You know, it's knowing things of the ethers, who we are and what we are. We have the power to do anything, and we just don't realize that we've been told otherwise. But our little group of people have stayed in the ethers to learn what we've learned, and we know who and what we are, and we know what the same about our brothers and sisters, and they can do the same thing. So at that, he said, well, how do these things operate? And they could look through. We had transparent skin around the craft, and there was no ignition switch, there was no steering wheel, there was no... He said, oh, that thing can't fly. And he said, no, it doesn't fly. It levitates and it teleports. It goes through and beyond this thing called time and space. And the guy was flipping out, and he's all, man, at that time, Carr raised it off the ground using consciousness. We all concentrated on it, and it came off the ground about 6 inches up. And these engineers that he had with him, they started taking pictures, and they came over and said, you mind taking your jackets off? They thought we were remotely controlling this thing. Said, no, let's take a look. And if you want us to take our shoes off and everything. And they checked us all out for remotes, and they told the rep, well, it's working, but it can't work because it's in violation of all the known laws. Then Carr went on to explain that he equated it to I don't know if Carr did it at that time or not, but it's equated to well, they've done it for years. They're operating now most of your big black ops are operated with just conscious control. You don't need steering gears anymore and stuff. And you can equate that back to, I think they made a movie called Firefox with, well, I know they did, with Clint Eastwood, where he had to go steal a jet from Russia and fly it just with his...
I'll remember where you were, but let me tell you about an experience I had.
Okay, good.
Back in the, about 1990-91, my wife and I were living in American Fork, Utah, and... one night she sent me down to Fred Meyer, the big drugstore, to get something. And whenever I went out at night and came home, I'd always get out in the driveway and look toward the pole star and maybe say a little prayer. And this night, it ran through my head, the thought, it says, turn around to the south and look up. Okay. So here... I'm going, okay, and there's no street lights on this street. About two blocks away, there was a ball game going on, so there was a little bit of light, but not much. But anyway, I saw what looked like, first I thought it was a bird flying, you know, because sometimes you see birds fly at night. And I thought, that's not a bird, it's perfectly round. It looks like a smoke-colored, mirrored ball. And then all of a sudden, this, I'm not talking about 60 feet off the ground, 100 at the most. All of a sudden, this huge flying wing comes right over me. And you got to remember, I'm a trained observer. I've been an astronomer since I was 12 years old. And this thing, the wingspan was at least 100 feet, and it had two pipe nacelles. Not on the tips of the wings, but about halfway in. And I just watched this thing pass over me in utter disbelief. And then... And that was one experience. And then the summer of 2009, I was getting ready to go to bed and was sleeping in an RV at my friend's house in Walsenburg, Colorado. And I kind of heard a rumble, and I looked up and I saw, I know what an aircraft looks like, but I saw a isosceles triangle shaped craft. It had didn't have the nav lights, you know, the green and the red nav lights. Instead, it had it had a red light on each corner. It had a light in the center on the belly, and then it had kind of an amorphous, not right on the tip of the triangle, kind of off to the side, kind of a. I could tell it was kind of a globe or something, and I reported this thing to MUFON, and the next day a guy told me, he says it might be a new generation TR-3 of the TR-3B. Craft that our government operates, and the MUFON guys, you know, came out to the neighborhood, and we were afraid to answer the door that day. We didn't give the exact address; we just gave the street coordinates, but it made the made the local newspaper. But you know, I've seen UFOs on and off since I was 6 years old. When my family was moving to California, we left. Northern Texas one night. Dad used to like to get up about 3 o'clock in the morning and be on the road by, you know, 4. And mom and sister were asleep in the back seat, and I was in the front, you know, looking up through the windshield. And I saw this cigar-shaped craft with 3 ventral fins buzz us and just go out of sight. Dad felt it, you know, and the hair went up on the arms, all our arms, and the electrical system of the car momentarily kind of jumped, and he said, "What was that?" And I said, "I saw it, Dad." And I've had other experiences too. So but I understand the triangle ships are our own government ships.
All of them are,
okay.
And they're working with electromagnetism, and they can mount weapons on those. The craft that we in the interest of time, I'm going to jump ahead to tell your audience. We're working on these things now. We've got what's called pods, just small groups of people that are
the like minds that working from the spirit to reintroduce free energy devices. And we want boxes and that we can give off to people. They can go anywhere and induce electricity. They don't need telephone poles and wires and things like that. And the Black Ops tried to, well, I'll jump ahead a little with my story and tell you what happened to us, and that's where a lot of our technology went. But it went without spirit. Without spirit, you can't do anything but live in the third dimension forever. You can't go to heaven. You can't even go to hell. Because you're already in it. No, I'm
yeah.
Not in it. No, it's a beautiful place. But people put themselves there. They don't.
Right.
Well, anyway, so because I want to tell you about the consciousness, because that I know your audience is wondering, what are you talking about? And what I'm saying is the source of life itself lies within us. It's not outside of us. This is all really illusion out here, and we're creating it in microseconds. It doesn't really exist. And that's a hard one for people to wrap their heads around, because they say, what are you talking about? I'm touching my body right now. I know this is real. Yeah, it's real. In your mind, you have created a dense form of vibration held together in sympathetic resonance with magnetism. And it is your creation that you're experiencing. You're reflecting who and what you are in a reality that was supposed to be fun, but you guys turned it into a mess. So you got to get yourself back out of it. So, this was proven to me when I was working in advanced kinetic. Down the line, the guy was on an electron microscope, and I used to have lunch with him. And one day we were talking about subjects like this, and he says, you know, I built this little jig. Come on over here and put your finger in it. So I went over and stuck my finger in this little jig, and he says, now look down the scope. And I looked down the scope where my finger was, and I didn't see anything. I just saw energy, just pure nothing but energy, just like you look at the stars, only they were all moving at incredible speed.
Really?
I pulled my finger out and stuck it back in, pulled it out. He says, that's right, you're energy. You're nothing but energy. You're just producing this idea, this illusion of a denser reality, and it's not that you're going to ever lose it, because you're the creator of all. Your energy never dies. It's always been and it always will be, and that's what we all are. And so when Marcia's flagging me, what does it mean?
Well, I want you to tell them how you actually teleported the crowd.
Oh yeah. Let me tell you.
That is very important, because it is done that way.
Okay. So anyway, if the audience wants to check it out on now they're operating all these black ops on they don't have steering gears and they don't have ignition switches. It's all done with, well, they're still using diodes in some cases, but it's all done with impulses from the brain. But that's where it stays in the third dimension. They can't take those ships any further than our ionosphere. But getting back if I haven't lost the audience yet. Anyhow, getting back to where we were, Carr said, the guy said, well, he said, you guys are outlaws, and what about, what's your power? And he said, it's magnetism. It's everywhere. You can take these things to the multiverse, the edges of the multiverse, and never run out of fuel. There's it's all energy, and we're using energy for our fuel. As simple as that. And the guy's, you know, it's the same thing that reflecting back to J.P. Morgan was saying, you're gonna ruin us all. You're gonna have cars running on magnetic energy. That fuel company's not gonna like that. And Carr was trying to explain, this doesn't have to be a drastic thing. We can do this overnight, just slowly, just introduce these technologies and let the others be where they are. Nobody has to give up their Corvettes. But there's some of us that like to get spaceships. So, well, anyway, to get on, because Marsha wants me to tell you what happened. But he said, well, "Okay, I'll tell you guys." And he says another thing: you're gonna Turk off the insurance company when you, cause you say they can't crash. No, crashing is obsolete, and you can't have weapons on it. Yeah, these are run by love. And the guy said, oh, bull. You guys put them up. You guys are outlaws. And he ran us off. He said, you guys get out of here. And you guys put them up, we'll shoot them down. That's what he told us. That's the exact words. So Carr says, thank you very much. Bye. Come on, boys. We better... They're onto us now. They're going to blow our cover. Die high. We better get back. We had a couple of 45-foot crafts that we were working on. We had one that was just... It was ready to go. We just had to do a little touch-up on it. And minor readjustment. The car said we were going to take the 45-footer, and he, by honor, elected me, and I'm just a lab tech, with two brilliant engineers to be one of the people that got on board. And I was really humbled. I thought, well, man, that's great. And he already explained, he said, now remember what I told you. Let your mind do the work, not your brain, because your brain will say it can't happen, it doesn't exist, it won't work. But your mind knows there's nothing impossible. Go in, sit down, shut up. Yeah. And focus on the crystal, the giant crystal in the center of the craft. We were up in the cabin. And underneath that was a bright laser light that came up through the bottom. I say laser, I'm not sure what it was, but it was brilliant like a laser. And we were working on lasers in the lab, so it looked familiar to me. But it lit this crystal up in millions of colors. I mean, like from infrared all the way around to ultraviolet. It was just thousands and thousands of different shades of red and yellows and greens and blues. And then it started changing to the color of aquamarine. And what had happened... And we'd learned this later, that the engineers had gone downrange about 10 miles a couple of days before and measured the field down there that we were going to take this craft to as equating to the light spectrum color of aquamarine. And he said, just go in and relax. Take all the trash out of your brain. Don't think of anything, because if you think, you're going to slow things down. Just relax. So we went in. And pretty soon this color turned into this outstandingly beautiful aquamarine. And the whole ship on the inside is aquamarine. Really a beautiful color. And we felt really good. And we were told later it reached the Schumann frequency of the Earth spin, which is 8.7 or 8 hertz per second. And when you reach that resonant frequency, you do feel excellently good because you're in tune with mom, with Mother Earth. So anyway, and then before we knew it, he said, okay, that's it, boys. Come on down for debriefing. And we looked at each other and we didn't go anywhere. We didn't do nothing. And they concurred, yep, that's right. We didn't do nothing, man. Something must have gone wrong. We better go down and see what's going on. And we were sealed in the cabin. Nobody came on board, and we were, for the most part, our minds were wide awake. Our brain was probably loafing somewhere, but our minds were really keenly aware of what was going on. So we went down and went into Carr's office, and he said, well, how'd it go, boys? And we didn't go anywhere, did it? Was something go wrong or what? And we had these jumpsuits on, little jumpsuits. We cleaned up before we went on board and put the jumpsuits on. And we said, well, we didn't do anything. And he said, oh, you didn't? No, we didn't. He said, well, empty your pockets. Well, we knew we didn't have anything in our pockets. We went up there with nothing in our pockets, and nobody got on board. But all of a sudden, we were emptying out stones and sticks and grass and all kinds of stuff and putting them on top of his desk. And he said, oh, really? Well, where did that come from? Tell me. And we had no idea. We thought, whoa, what is going on? He said, well, I told you boys about consciousness. The mind is in control of this, not the brain. The brain doesn't know anything about the ethers. It knows about
atmosphere and stratosphere and ionosphere. It doesn't know anything about, very little about the ethers, except for the people like Tesla and Moray and Schomburger and a few others who have dared to enter the realms of the ethers and bring the knowledge forth to free mankind from the servitude that it's been in for a long time. So anyway, we said, well, how exactly did that happen? He said, well, you went beyond. You went outside of time and space. Time and space doesn't really exist where you in the ethers. It exists in dimensions like you're inhabiting here in your experience of a human body, but it's measurement. Point A to point B, you measure it, and that's it. That's the fourth dimension, the time and space. But where you jump to was the fifth dimension or beyond. That's, these are words put on ideas, and you can define them any way you want, but that's what he was saying to us. And so the brain, you quieted yourself down well enough to successfully, you know, teleport through time and space. And what you did, you went downrange, and your brain will deny this forever if you let it. But you're going to have to educate your brain someday and start realizing through the mind that all these things happen. And it may take weeks, months, or years. And now I've got almost total recall of it. I remember almost every detail. But later on when I was doing this interview for Project Camelot, a police officer from Apple Valley sent an email to us, and he said, I saw you on Project Camelot. He said, you know, I think we've seen you guys. Did you have jumpsuits on? I said, yeah. And he said, well, we were out on patrol, and we saw your craft come in. It was bright blue, and then it came down and set for just a few minutes. Three men got out and fooled around for a few minutes. Before we could get over there, the whole thing disappeared. Yeah, that was us.
Wow.
Carr said, now they're gonna be on to us now, and they're gonna try and shut us down. They don't want this technology here. They're gonna fight tooth and nail to the death if necessary. So we're gonna get this craft going now. We got it operational, and we can, and using resonant, you know, frequencies, resonant vibration, we can go anywhere. We're free of gravitational field, totally. All you have to do is resonate on. It's like two tuning forks or two guitars across the room. You strike a key of G, and the key of G across the room will go, or a piano, the same thing.
Right.
So he said, now we're going to take this big craft, we're going to go over L.A. first, and then we're going to hit every city in the United States, and then we're going to go around the world. And just bells and whistles and lights and everything we can do, so people look up and say, wait a minute, there's something up there we don't understand. And have them make inquiries until they get truthful answers from the powers that be without the disguise of Homeland Security and everything in the way. So we got ready. We were getting ready to do that, and about 2-3 days later, these two semis pulled up loaded with armed guards, soldiers, and they jumped out of the back of the trucks, and these guys pulled up in these black cars, and we thought, we got their attention, all right, and these guys came out with their little FBI badges and CIA badges, and wanted to see Carr, so we all stood up behind Carr. While this guy read us a piece of paper, it said we're cease and desist or whatever it was, and we're shutting you down, we're confiscating everything in the name of blah, blah. You were attempting to overthrow the monetary system of the United States.
Majestic 12 law, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they said this could be construed as high treason, and we can kill you. So anyway...
I don't know how much time we got, but I've got more to tell you here.
We've got 22 minutes left.
Okay. All right, good. So anyway, they did. They took us off and started interrogating us, and they were loading up the truck. They pulled our files out, brutally pulled our files up and put them in boxes and tore our stuff right out of the engine lathe. They take parts and everything and loaded them up in boxes and hauled them off. And they talked, had us all separated, and they were talking to us. And told us that we were never to talk to each other again. We're never to talk about what we were doing here. And we were going to be watched, and we were going to be surveilled for the rest of our lives. They'd know everywhere we were. They don't ever try this again. Well, Carr had told us in advance, he said, this might happen. And he says, what you do is use the source, use the force of the source for your power. Know the truth and stick with it, and they can't touch you. Because they are you too, and you are they. So they cannot harm you without harming themselves. So stand knowing that and stay with that, and you'll never have to worry.
What a courageous man.
Yeah, he was. He was. So we did, and so that was, we dispersed and everything, and that killed Carr. He finally, you know, expired in the hospital. He went back and
82.
Said, well, I didn't make it. I mean, I surmised that because I talked to him once or twice, and I could hear that we were being, you know, the phone was bugged and stuff, and then I had these people show up in a supermarket. They come up and bump into me, and we told you, don't say another word, you know, and all this, and your family's at risk, and all this stuff. And I said, okay, yeah.
And here your wife wanted you to get out of diving so you'd be safer, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, this is the part I wanted to get to, that we'd never give up. For 50 years now, I've never stopped designing and rebuilding the concept and dreaming, using my full imagination, because that's the power of the universe. I had to go through a death experience. I died, Marcia was with me when I died in the hospital, and there's no death. It was a split second, and they wheeled my whole body out, and the next thing I knew, I was taken off with Marcia for where we are now, to go out and tell people, don't live in fear, because fear will drive you nuts. And that's a monkey brain. You'll always think about it and always have to look over your shoulder. Just be who you are. You're a magnificent being. You're a beautiful being, and you have talents that we need you. Come to each other's aid, one for all for one. Let's work together and build a better world than the one we're presently seem to be stuck in. So
what year was that they came for you?
That was 1960 when they busted
us. The next year they convicted Carr of selling securities without registering the same in Oklahoma. They went after 1960.
Yeah.
Wow.
Can you tell them about the book?
Oh yeah. Well, when Carr went to put in a patent, because he was just earnestly, sincerely trying to help mankind. He says, well, let's get off the ground. He went through the patent office and said, I want to build spaceships, and here's my patent. And it had levitation and the principles of teleportation in the patent. And the patent people said, no, man, you can't. That's not in our conventional physics. You're in the third dimension here, buddy. You don't even talk about vibrations or resonance or levitation, or they don't exist in our dimension here. I mean, they didn't say it that way, but I'm kind of ad-libbing here. But they said the only way we give you a patent is if you pull those ideas out. That's the essence of natural law. Pull those ideas out, and we'll give you a patent on an amusement device.
Yeah, the amusement device, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what they did. But Carr never gave up. And he said, all right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to put all the natural laws in this book and write it into poetry. Just beautiful essence. I'll go
meditate and watch the hummingbirds and see how they equate to resonant frequencies or sacred geometry or the flower of life or the golden mean. And then I'll equate it, something like a hummingbird at 1 minute to 12 on the 14th of July will resonate at a certain frequency because the sun's hitting the wing at a certain angle and so forth. Well, he wouldn't exactly put it that way. He'd just say, I saw this beautiful bumblebee or I saw this beautiful hummingbird at noon. And anyhow, he's writing poetry. But disguised in that, encoded in that with all the natural laws of sacred geometry, of ether technology, esoteric understanding. And he said, the day will come when somebody will come along and decode this book. When that happens, it's all over. The world that has been known as a giant prison will be over forever. You'll see all the big shots crumbling. You'll see them coming down one by one, 10 by 10, and the age of love will come back. The age of abundance will come back. So anyway, I don't know how I'm doing on time, but I'll tell you what happened. About 15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Okay. Well, we
use it all.
We've redesigned these craft for years now. We've gone into solid state circuitry. We have no moving parts. Digital. We put all this in it. Now we have supercraft ready to go, and they're waiting in the wings. And it's not that we're not ready to produce these things. It's the consciousness that has to wake up and allow us to give them these gifts that we want to give them. It's technology. Is the core of the technology is what we call the utron. It's an electrical accumulator, not a generator. Everybody wants to call it a generator. It doesn't generate electricity. It accumulates the energy around it. The magnetic fields are constantly pulsating. We have part of our extended group is the producers of a movie called Thrive, Thrive, and the designer of the graphic arts and everything is a good friend of ours, and he calls it the Taurus. And it shows how the if your audience ever wants to see a good movie, it's free for download, I believe, now on the internet. It will show how who we are, what we are, and how the energy flows. And like a Mobius twist, there's no beginning or end, and there's always that center point, which is zero point. That's where we are now. We're going down into a black hole. We're going down to the eye of the needle, and we have to become pure enough to go through that, because we are apt to go right through the center of the sun to go to the next dimension.
What
I know
was the
that
name
sounds
of the movie?
Really bizarre, but just mark my words.
What was the name of the movie?
Huh?
What's the name of the movie to download?
Oh, Thrive. 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 And it's produced by a descendant of the, he's a relative of the, you know, you heard of Procter & Gamble. What he saw Procter & Gamble going the same way Monsanto was going, and he said, enough of this crap. I'm going to create this movie. And he spent 7 years and millions of dollars putting this movie together. And it's really worth the audience. I mean, it will really change your perception on what's happening right now. We're in the midst of a gigantic change. We know people back east that are coming out now telling us their engineers and chemists are looking for jobs in free energy because they're these big companies are folding up like every day. There's Kodak, Eastman Kodak in Rochester,
yeah.
New York, folded. Xerox folded. Barcelone folded. These are all big companies that are just folded because they were producing chemicals for the pharmaceutical companies and everything.
Well, Kodak was, I think, one of the world's biggest users of gold.
Well,
and so that's making it a little easier on the planet, because the Hopi were saying, hey, don't take the gold out of the earth because it's Mother Earth's nervous system. And anyway, go ahead.
Well, it's all starting to crumble. I mean, you know, these things are happening every day. The head of the chokehold on the media company has always been Rupert Murdoch. Yeah. And he was just forced to resign here a couple of days ago. So that's going to change everything on the media. They're going to start bringing the truth out again for a change one of these days. And so anyway, we got these pods, and they're all over the world. We got them in Hawaii. We got them in Australia. Our webmaster is in Australia, and he's doing a heck of a job networking for us. We're getting more than we can handle all the time, and we have to delegate some of the emails and Skypes and everything that we get. But we're building these things now, and we're just kind of waiting in the wings for the consciousness to accept and to change your perception from just being a human body to a magnificent being, and accepting the fact that they will be able to do all these things and more someday because they can do it with their mind. But in the meantime, we can keep building sports cars and sports crafts and flying saucers or whatever you want, so that they can enjoy life and make it a lot easier. And these little boxes, you trying to go in a little box about the size of a suitcase, well, even smaller, you can get them down to probably about the size of a postage stamp. You carry them in the park with like a flash drive, and anywhere they go, they can produce electricity because they can convert the energy to electricity, so we don't need wires and telephone poles and stuff anymore. But it all has to do with consciousness, to appreciate who and what we are and where we are, living in the now. There is no past, there is no future. But if we live right now and know who we are and remember, no more learning, but remember who and what we are and stand strong against the opposition, it's going to increase the pace that we're accelerating at now, and it's happening overnight. We're getting scores of people, engineers coming out of engineering school, wanting to come into alternative energy, with brilliant minds, and it's happening. We're now producing some of our parts with 3D printers. We put the idea in through a printer, it scans the idea, and produces some of the parts that we're putting into our models. And you can type in 3D printers,
mm-hmm.
and even skin guns. That's another new.
Yeah, they every once in a while you see them on TV shows how they work.
Yeah, well,
amazing.
Yeah, they got a full-blown chopper now, made from a 3D printer. And Marcia's grabbing the phone.
I just want to fill in one part of the puzzle here. The book that Otis T. Carr wrote, mm-hmm. The Dimensions of Mystery, has now been decoded within the last 3 months by one of our people in Australia. That's Ben Hallett, and he's a young man, a young farmer, and he's actually done a brilliant job. And there again, you can see this book. The decoding of the book is on the website, the Blue Star Enterprise. So to me, that was Otis's saying that when that is decoded, it is time. Everything points, all of the Hopi prophecy, all of the different prophecies, as you know, you're aware of, it's so amazing. It's so exciting because we're right in the midst of this change that's happening.
All you have to do is just put in Dimensions of Mystery, Otis Carr. He apparently put it up on ScribD. It's on projectcamelot.org/dimensions of mystery. It's there. All anybody has to do is just go look for it.
Well, that's the book, but the decoded part of it is on the is on our website, Blue Star Enterprise.
Oh, okay.
Because they could see the decoding. It'll match it word for word. Like, you know, if they're talking about a bumblebee, they're talking about resonant frequency, because bumblebees levitate, they don't fly. And it'll show right across the board what it means. And
do you feel like back in 91, when I was really just started getting things through spirit, I was told, quote, someday there will be a fake UFO invasion. And do you feel is this what's going on right now? You know,
it's happening right now.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's fake. They're,
well,
they're what they're doing.
Themselves.
Well, no, wait a minute. I'll back up a little bit. They're trying
they're trying desperately to create the idea that we're going to be invaded by aliens and so forth. Well, anybody coming out of the ethers, coming to another dimension, a planetary system, are in essence using love to operate.
Right.
So anything that isn't in a sphere and a spirit of love can scare the heck out of you. But
yeah.
But there's no such thing as fear, and so they are trying to build this idea that we're going to be invaded and they're going to take over and these reptilians are going to come out of the woodwork or up the toilets or I don't know where they come from. But it's not real. The only thing real is our own consciousness and our trust in spirit, in, our trust in self and source and the force. And while we're on a subject of Blue Star, because people have asked me, where'd you get that? That name, I built an underground house in Prescott or Chino Valley, Arizona. And like I say, I'd been going back and forth. I had some Kopi friends, and they were aware of what I was building. And I built it on a it took about 2 weeks for the land to accept my wife and I at the time to build this. We had to get the feeling that this we were accepted. We had to be invited. Anyhow, we started building this underground house, and it was just the exact replica of the 45-foot craft that we built, and we had tourmaline crystal and quartz crystal embedded in the walls and so forth. But the point was that I wanted to start another laboratory. I've had several laboratories all over, and every time the planning and zoning would show up, or the IRS, or somebody would try and slow us down or stop us. So I decided, I learned one day, just wait, because someday they're going to paint themselves in a corner and there's no way out but the visionaries, but the inventors, but the discoverers, and now our time is here, and that's what's going to happen. But during that time, the Hopi's elders came down, and they paid me the greatest honor I could ever have, because this is built like a kiva, it's built like a hogan, and they gave a sacred ceremony, and saw, they knew what we were doing, their souls knew what we were doing, and they gave us power to never give up, you know, keep going. So I kept that with us, and at the time, we carved our road, we carved everything out there, but we had a road adjacent to where we were building, and we were coming home one night, and my wife and I looked down up the road, and coming through the sky was this blue orb, big, beautiful blue orb, slow, it wasn't fast at all. And as we were approaching the road, it came right in front of our windshield, and it's just a beautiful blue, electric blue light orb. And we turned down the road to see where it was going, wanted to see if it was going to land or crash. And we followed it all the way up until it disappeared up about where our house was going to be built and where it was built. And we said, well, what was it? And so it was a star. It must have been a falling star. So we called it, well, Blue Star. Okay, we'll call the road Blue Star.
Well,
so everything
was,
kind of emanated from that. And then
it was them letting you know that they knew what you're going on and what you're trying to do, and they were encouraging you, whoever they were.
Yeah, they were. They were.
And Will, the road is still named Blue Star Road.
There's a picture of it on your website.
Oh, okay.
Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, that's how they came about it. And I don't know. I know we're running out of time, but I just want to tell the audience, man, just be who you are. Stand up for your rights, for who you are. You have a right to be the infinite being that you are. And you're always on your own time. You don't have to buy into anybody else's time.
Hey, we got 3 minutes. If anybody wants to call in, call us at 347-996-3318, 347-996-3318, otherwise, you know, we can leave it there if you want to, and unless you have something else to say, or I can end the show with The Lights by Robbie Robertson.
Okay, I'll let it be your call, Will, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk, and I hope I didn't go too far into the forest with people.
Oh, no, appreciate you. Okay.
And everything is frames of reference. Everything's real, and it's how you perceive it at the moment.
and nothing in the past or future exists, just for now. That's what I'd like to be with.
Thanks. Be in touch.
Sagonie, a seventh great grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Let the truth be known.